Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Alison Moores. Thank you, Alison. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and welcome to everyone who's listening live and anyone who is going to come and listen to this later on. So I'm, as Ian said, I'm a surgery specialist. I've had my diploma for about 11 or 12 years, so I hope I've got lots of experience to bring you based on those years. I have also spent some time working in emergency practice, so back in the days when emergency clinics were just starting, I spent a period of time working full-time in one of those, and then I also worked in an emergency clinic all the way through my residency, and saw an awful lot of GDVs during that time because we did have a lot of giant dog breeders around, so I feel I've seen my fair share of them. So what I'm hoping to share with you is some of the information that is in the literature based on large studies of dogs with GDVs and also a little bit of my experience from managing the dogs. So I've got a number of things that I want to cover during the course of today, and we're going to break the talk up into the pathogenesis and pathophysiology, and then go through diagnosis and treatment and aftercare. So we see, on the whole, we see animals with GDVs, but we will also have other related syndromes. So there are some dogs who will have just gastric dilatation, and there are those dogs who just seem to be chronic bloaters. So whether they've had apexia or not, they do have a tendency to get dilations. And we will also see some chronic volvulus cases. Those ones are a little bit more tricky because we don't always know what's going on with them, and they don't have that classic GDV presentation. Now, there used to be some dispute about what came first. So did the torsion come first or did the dilation come first? And generally now it's thought that it is the volvulus that comes first, on the basis that the majority of animals who have apexia then won't go on to get another volvulus, but also studies of the gas that's contained within the stomach show that it's gas that's trapped gas that's been created rather than gas that's been gulped in, so we don't have an aerophagia component to it. And the volvulus is thought to come about because the hepatogastric ligaments are very stretchy in these dogs. And for a while it wasn't known whether those stretch ligaments were the cause of the volvulus or whether that happened because of the volvulus, but it's thought now that that's part of the underlying cause. And so we have animals who have a really large body cavity. They have a tendency to get a full stomach, and so that will really stretch those ligaments. They'll also stretch with age, and they'll also stretch in animals who have a tendency for hypomotility, which we do know is a factor in dogs with GDVs. And we'll also see it more commonly in the lean dogs, and it's thought that that's because there's less support to the stomach, so it can move around a little bit more easily. And so as soon as we get the volvulus, then we find that we can't get any way out for the fluid or the gas that's accumulating. So the animals can't eructate because they have gastroesophageal sphincter dysfunction, and they'll also have pyloric dysfunction, and they lose the motility, and so we go on to develop the GDV. We know that there are certain breeds that are at risk, and the Great Dane is our classic dog who has the greatest risk. And while there are studies that show some from the US, and these are the dogs listed here from the US study, and studies in other countries show that there are certain breeds who do have a breed predisposition, there are some dogs who aren't included in these studies because there aren't actually enough of those dogs to work out whether there is a statistical significance or not. So we would generally think that any giant or large breed dog is at risk, particularly if they have that classic conformation. And there are also some of the slightly more medium breeds, like the Basset, who have the right conformation but aren't necessarily considered as a large breed dog. And then we also see the Dachshund, for example, who's at a greater risk of developing GDV. So we need to keep our eyes open at all times. So what is it about certain breeds that make them likely to develop the GDV? Well, it's really thought to be related to that increased thoracic depth to width ratio. Within those individual breeds, we'll see it more as animals get older, when they're thinner. And we'll also see that there's animals have more likely to get a GDV if they had a first degree relative who's had it. So if they've had a parent, offspring or sibling who had a GDV, then they're more likely to get it, which really suggests that there is more of a genetic link to it than just breed alone. We also notice it's more common in the fearful and the nervous dogs. So if we move on to the next slide and have a think about the environmental factors that may make any one of those dogs prone to develop it, the first thing you'll see here is the environmental stress. And that's really, really important for us for two reasons. One, animals going into kennels, being increased risk of a GDV, it's really, really useful for these owners to know that that's a risk, because we really do need to be able to get hold of them in the event of a GDV when they're when owners are on holiday. The other thing is hospitalisation. So if you can avoid hospitalising dogs after they've had a minor procedure, then that will reduce the risk of GDV. What we don't really want to do is to have done a minor surgery in a Great Dane, keep it hospitalised for 2 days and discover it develops a GDV when maybe that dog would have been more comfortable at home. Studies have also looked at feeding habits, and these are a little bit difficult because there are some variations in the outcomes from different studies. But on the whole, these are some of the risk factors. So eating from a raised bowl, eating large food volumes, particularly if they're eating in one go from once daily feeding, and fast eating. So we try to advise our clients, again, of the at-risk breeds, and particularly if they've had a GDV episode and we want to avoid them having a dilation again, to try to feed them more regularly, so 3 to 4 meals a day, and to try and slow down the eating, so maybe using a Kong. So that this is something that I would want to talk about with my at-risk patients. Also, if you look at the diet, if the diet's got an oil or fat listed in the first 4 ingredients, then they're at increased risk if they have a single food type or small food particles. So it's also been shown that if you give dogs table scraps and a more varied diet, then they're less likely to get the GDV. There's differing opinions on whether it's related to exercise or not. So some studies have shown a relation to exercise, some haven't. And one study has shown that actually dogs who went for moderate exercise after eating actually had a reduced risk. Foreign bodies might increase the risk. Aerophagia won't. So animals who are gulping and stressful, probably this isn't the cause of the GDV. So let's have a look at what happens to the dog. So it's important to understand the pathophysiology, because we need to know what we're treating and why we're treating it to really try to get the best outcome. So if we just look at briefly at the schematic of how the stomach rotates so that you can think about how to untwist it afterwards. So I've drawn it here with the view that we would see in surgery. So we've got the esophagus came down into the cardia, we've got the body of the stomach here, we've got the pyloric antrum, pylorus, and going down into the duodenum. So what we're going to see is the pylorus here is essentially going to make its way over to the left side of the dog, and then the body is going to move around here. And eventually what we find is as it twists further and further round, we can see the pylorus is now making its way up onto the left-hand side, the body is now on the right-hand side, and then we'll see the body of the stomach getting really, really big here, and the pylorus is going to be tucked away up in the top left quadrant, and we'll often find the duodenum coming across the cranial aspect here, so that it's going to be going back down this side on the right, because remember it's going to be tethered by the mesoduodenum. So when we talk about derotating the stomach later on, the important thing to remember is we need to go looking for the pylorus here in the cranial left quadrant. And for me, that was really what made the difference in being able to derotate these dogs quickly and not quickly, was being able to locate the pylorus. As soon as we've got the pylorus, then that really does help in untwisting the stomach. Okay, so what's the most significant thing that's going to happen to the dog to give it morbidity? And the first thing is going to be the effect of the size of the stomach on the venous return. So our direct cardiovascular effects are what are going to cause the initial clinical signs in this dog and why it's going to be so collapsed when it comes in. So the The large stomach is going to compress the vena cava and the portal vein and other small veins in the abdomen, and that's going to reduce venous return. And we'll talk about this later on when we're thinking about which catheters we're going to put in. If you put an IV catheter in the saphenous vein of the dog, then any fluids you put in are still going to be stuck in the caudal end of the dog because we don't have venous return. So any fluid you put in the caudal aspect of the dog isn't going to get to the heart. And that's why we aim for cephalic catheters, so that we can get that fluid going into the heart via the cranial cava rather than the caudal cava. So that decreased venous return is going to decrease cardiac output. It's going to give you that decrease in systemic blood pressure, and we will term this the obstructive shock. So because we are losing our venous return, we're going to find that the animal has portal hypertension. So the portal vein is going to be flattened and the blood can't come out through the portal vein, so we have portal hypertension. So increased blood pressure in the intestines and in the spleen, and we'll see pooling of fluid in the splanchnic organ, so we call that splanchnic pooling. At the same time, we will have production of various factors from the ischemic or just from the hyperperfused stomach and spleen. One of the most important ones of those that's been studied is nitric oxide, which is produced under the effects of hypoperfusion and ischemia, and that will cause vasodilation. And so we see distributive shock. And this is the most important factor in shock in the GDV dogs, and that's what we need to try to overcome. We will also see some hypovolemic shock, and actually this is much less significant in a GDV patient than the other types of shock, and much less so than in animals such as the bleeding spleen that you may see, where we have hypovolemic shock as our main problem. So hypovolemic shock comes about due to a lack of vascular volume. A little bit of this may be blood loss, but actually we don't tend to see much bleeding in GDVs. It's much more that we are seeing third spacing and excess GI secretions. And our final category of shock is the cardiogenic shock. So animals will have cardiac arrhythmias, or may have cardiac arrhythmias. Actually, very, very high percentage of dogs will have arrhythmias either on presentation or actually will develop them during the course of their GDV. And the arrhythmia may be due to release of toxins from after the animal's had its stomach derotated. So we will see a reperfusion injury. We've already mentioned nitric oxide as an example, and we also see something called myocardial depressant factor. The other problem we have is that if we think back up to the top of this slide, we've got decreased venous return, we've got decreased cardiac output, and that means that we have decreased blood flow specifically to the heart. And the heart is very, very sensitive, and it will quite quickly undergo subendocardial necrosis, and we may see cardiac arrhythmias secondary to ischemic damage to the heart. So when we think about animals who are shocky, we need to think about whether they are compensating or whether they have got to the point where they are now no longer able to compensate and they're decompensated. Most of the GDVs that I see are still in the stage of compensatory shock. So they're tachycardic, the pulses are very, very bounding, they may well be tachypneic as well. We tend to see those injected red mucous membranes. This is quite an extreme example of them. I normally don't find they're quite this injected, and as we'll talk about on the next slide, we'll find that the capillary refill time will be quite quick, so usually about a second. These animals are usually normothermic, and they will respond very, very well to fluid therapy. Once we've gone into decompensatory shock, we tend to find animals are bradycardic, the pulses are very weak, the animals will often be hypothermic, and we actually can't usually find or demonstrate the capillary refill time because actually the gums are so pale. And those animals don't respond overly well to fluid therapy. So I've just got some videos of various animals that have come in with different stages of hypovolemia, but I just start off with a normovolemic. This dog happens to be reasonably pink, but that capillary refill time is 2 seconds. So this was just a normal dog whose gums I've borrowed just to demonstrate what normal would look like, and we'll just play that again. So these are not excessively pink. We've got a capillary refill time of a couple of seconds. We'll look at some of the examples of some recent... Also, if we can pop up the next video. Okay, so here's some hypovolemic cases. So this first dog, we can see that the gums is actually quite a similar pink colour to the other one. And sometimes the capillary refill time looks quite slow, sometimes it's quite quick. But you can see here that capillary refill time is quicker than the previous dog. We see another example here, that capillary refill time is quite quick. Mucous membranes are pink, but they're not desperately injected. And then here we have a dog whose capillary refill time is a lot slower. We haven't yet got to the point where that gum colour is very, very pale, but we'll find that this dog may well be starting to lose its bounding pulses, and actually that pulse might be starting to get a little bit weaker. The most important thing when we're monitoring these animals for shock is to actually see a change in the clinical status. So when we're treating with fluid therapy, we want to see those clinical indicators improve. Okay, so going back to the pathophysiology, we'll also have a significant effect on the thoracic cavity. So a very large stomach is going to press on the diaphragm, and the animal is going to be hypoventilating because they're unable to increase their lung volume sufficiently because of the pressure of the stomach. And actually, a fair number of dogs with GDVs will actually have aspiration pneumonia. It's not always so apparent on presentation because actually there are so many other things going on. But if you were to radiograph the chest, then you would recognise that aspiration pneumonia. And it's quite important so that we can think about treating it proactively in the postoperative period. So the hypoventilation will cause a ventilation perfusion mismatch. And what we will see in the animal will be hypoxemia initially. So always remember to try and give some oxygen therapy when these animals are coming in. They may be hypercapnic. We will see a respiratory acidosis, and that may or may not lead to an acidemia. But as we'll talk about in a moment, we've got to think about the other types of acidosis or alkalosis we may have. But we will certainly have a significant respiratory acidosis component to this dog's blood gas. Some dogs will suffer a lung collapse as well, and that will further decrease their ability to ventilate. And then we have the direct gastrointestinal effects. So these are really what's important in terms of whether you develop gastric necrosis or not. So this is not what we're treating as soon as the animal comes in, because remember I just said that we're much more concerned about the direct cardiovascular effects, but these gastrointestinal effects are going on at the same time, and these are what's going to potentially lead us to developing that gastric necrosis. So as the stomach dilates, we get an increase in gastric pressure, and the stomach is very, very sensitive, and any stomach that's dilated will have a reduction in myoelectrical activity and essentially won't move. And so we won't get any flow of ingesta out of the pylorus, even if it's not yet completely blocked. So we will get an accumulation of gas and fluid, and then we'll get ourselves into a little bit of a vicious cycle. The combination of the increase in gastric pressure, the reduction in the cardiac output, so this should be apologies here, this hasn't come out properly, this should be a decreased arrow. So we have a reduction in cardiac output and physical pressure of the portal vein will lead to a decrease in gastric perfusion. And it's really these two, the increased gastric pressure so that blood can't flow through the individual vessels in the gastric wall, and the fact that there's not much pressure and there's not much blood coming through the gastric arteries anyway. And then we'll have a small component contributing to this from avulsion of the short gastric arteries. And that decrease in gastric perfusion can lead to gastric hemorrhage and necrosis. And how severe that is and for what amount of time it is will determine whether the animal develops a complete gastric necrosis or not. We will also see some potential hemorrhage from avulsion of the short gastric arteries, but as I mentioned before, that doesn't tend to be hugely clinically significant compared with all the other types of shock that we see. And we certainly don't see the amount of bleeding that we might see from a ruptured spleen, for example. And then the metabolic effects are very important and will continue to be important in the post-operative period. So actually I've lumped a lot of things together in here just for ease of talking about it, but they are all going to be as equally important as each other, and any one of these could potentially contribute to our post-operative morbidity and mortality. So we do know that animals who have GDV can have quite severe coagulation dysfunction, and if we were to analyse the coagulation profile, we would see very often prolonged coagulation times. If we combine those with other clinical indicators, we would see that quite quickly a lot of our GDV patients do fulfil criteria for SIRS. But what is much more important is to be looking for those criteria in the post-operative period. So many animals will go on to look as though they're developing SIRS. We may see evidence of DIC. And also we may see a hypercoagulable state rather than just seeing consumptive state. And so we may have animals who develop thrombosis, particularly of the splenic vein. And so it may be that some animals need to have a repeat surgery to remove the spleen if we recognise that as a problem. Renal dysfunction is being recognised a little bit more often now, as we're a little bit more aware of potential of acute kidney injury. So we need to be monitoring animals in the post-operative period, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. The acid-base disorders in GDV can be a little bit confusing. So we can have one or all of a metabolic acidosis, metabolic alkalosis, and respiratory acidosis. Usually we'll find these animals are acidemic, but we may see a normal pH despite having underlying acid-base disorders. So I generally make the assumption that there is dysfunction here, even if we see a normal pH. Hypokalemia is not usually hugely significant, but it's something we need to start thinking about in the post-operative period, not necessarily in the pre-operative period. Hypokalemia may come about because of the underlying disease process, so we may see secretion of potassium into the stomach, we may see exchange of hydrogen ions in animals who are acidemic, but actually a lot of the hypokalemia is induced by us because most of the time we resuscitate with low potassium fluids. So we don't generally find that this is something to worry about in the pre-operative period, but it's something that I would be monitoring for in the post-operative period, and similarly I would be monitoring for hypoglycemia as well post-operatively. Okay, so let's think a little bit about the diagnostics. Most of the time I think the history and the physical examination findings are fairly obvious, particularly if it is a giant breed dog, and my experience has always been that most owners of the large and the giant breed dogs know what they're looking for and they will present them to you as a GDV. I think what's a little bit more difficult is if you have a breed where you aren't expecting it to be a GDV. So if you have any animal that's presenting where you think it's got an acute abdominal crisis, then we do need to have GDV on our radars. If we're not sure, radiography is going to be particularly important in those animals. But the other thing I've found is that of the animals where it's not always overly apparent when they first come in as to whether they've got a GDV, but I'm treating them for their shock and I've got them on fluids, actually you tend to find that the dilatation of the stomach becomes more and more apparent. And actually, if you weren't sure that it was a GDV to start with, you quite quickly become aware that you are getting gastric distension. I'm going to run through some of the tests that I like to run on the subsequent slides, but I just want to say as a reminder that obviously we combine our diagnostic tests with stabilising the animal. So while I'm talking about the diagnostics, obviously I will have been treating the animal, starting the fluid therapy, starting decompression, and all of those things are going on at the same time. So what sort of things do we like to think about? When you read the literature, there's a lot of information about blood tests, and they are very useful, but I think you need to consider what type of practice you work in and the availability of people essentially to run those blood tests. So I've treated GDVs in all sorts of situations, in private practice, private referral practice with lots of nurses, sometimes with just myself and one other nurse. And I think it is realistic to say you have to adapt what you're going to do diagnostically to the numbers of members of staff you have available to you. If there are just two people treating the GDV, then it's going to be extremely difficult to go off and run any blood tests. But I do think it's useful to take those samples, put them in a pot, potentially run them later on, so that you can use them to see whether you're improving things diagnostically, and maybe even run them post-operatively if you didn't have a chance to run them before surgery, so that you can have your baseline. So I've highlighted what I think would be my two favourite tests to start with: PCV, total protein, and electrolytes. I like to have a PCV just to get an idea of where we're at to start with, and electrolytes to see what our potassium's doing. I don't think they would neither of these would actually change what I was doing, but I've chosen those two because those are the tests that I think are most likely to be available in practice. What you do subsequent to that will obviously depend upon what analyzers you have available to you. So if you do have blood gas, it's extremely useful to be able to get a handle on what the acid base is doing, and so do you have metabolic acidosis, alkalosis, and really what we're dealing with there. Having said that, we would tend to make the assumption that the animal is suffering from those to a certain extent, and our fluid therapy will be correcting them. And we're lucky in our GDV patients that in the majority of them, crystalloid fluid therapy again tends to normalize most of the acid-base disorders. So we don't need to start thinking about whether we're going to use bicarbonate to treat them, and therefore it's less important for us to need to have that acid base than maybe in some other situations. The other test that I would like to have, if available, will be lactate. And we'll just talk a little bit more about lactate and why we might want to take it. So what we're really looking for is to say, is there any blood test that exists that will be prognostic for survival, so that we could say to a client, okay, your dog has a high level on this blood test, there's a 95% chance it will die, or there will be 95% chance that it will live. That would be our ideal. But it's not quite as easy as that. What we're looking for is a blood test or a series of blood tests that could be markers of tissue necrosis and markers of SIRS, but also whether those are going to be reversible. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on and see the difficulties with these tests. We've also got to consider their availability, the ease of use, and the cost of them. So there are lots of tests that are being considered at the moment, but actually we need to think about which one of those are currently available in the UK and are cheap enough that you would choose to keep those on your shelf, bearing in mind how many other things we have to keep in stock as well. And when we talk about whether they're prognostic for survival, and when papers are written about how good lactate, for example, is on prognosis, we need to know whether it's prognostic for populations or for individuals, because each owner of a GDV only has one dog. So they want to know, is my dog going to live or die? And it would be great to have a test that says, yes, yours will live or yours will die. But actually, what we don't have anything like that. We can only talk about populations. It's quite important for owners to understand what it means when we're measuring lactate if we choose to talk to them about it. So most of the other markers that are being looked at are not prognostic preoperatively, but I'm sure there will be plenty of study later on in subsequent years that will give us more information, and potentially more bedside tests will become available. So what does lactate mean? What does hyperlactemia mean? So it's divided up. Hyperlactemia is divided up into a couple of categories, essentially based on whether there is clinical evidence of tissue oxygen deficiency. And we are looking at those dogs that have got an absolute oxygen deficiency through hyperperfusion. You may just have be looking around the slide and you'll notice that we can sometimes see relative oxygen deficiency, but that would be muscle activity. So if you exercise, you may have hyperlactemia, but that's a normal physiological process. What we're looking at is the pathophysiological processes, the things that shouldn't happen. So if you have a GDV, you will have hypoperfusion. And the causes of the hyperperfusion we listed on the slide earlier on, the most significant one in the GDV is the maldistributive shock. And this type of hyperlactemia is what is reversible. So if we give fluid therapy and we increase perfusion and we derotate the stomach to improve perfusion, then we can get the lactate to come down. But we've also got to remember that there are other reasons for hyperlactemia that are not related to hypoperfusion. And so we may find some animals have a persistently high lactate despite treating them. And then we have to think about why that might be and why those animals aren't doing well, and to pay attention, because those are the animals who may have a more severe prognosis or more poor prognosis. And in particular, we would worry about animals having an underlying disease such as that they are developing SIRS. And so, as we'll see on a subsequent slide, those are the cases we're worried about. Now, we will see different lactate concentrations in different animals and at different times of presentation. So we need to be quite careful not to take the first measurement that we see, because it won't necessarily be accurate. So let's think about what's happening in the dog. So we've got a couple of photos here showing that we've got a dog who's still got a clinically significant GDV, and the splenic wall and the gastric wall are going to be hypoperfused and potentially ischemic, and we are going to have production of lactate. So the tissue lactate is going to be high, but the systemic lactate might not be, and it really depends upon whether there is sufficient blood flow back out of those tissues to put the lactate in the systemic circulation. So if there is poor gastric blood flow and poor venous return, that lactate is maybe low for a little while, and we might see that jump up later on. If we're seeing a little bit of blood flow coming out from those tissues, we might find the lactate's high. Doesn't actually mean that animal's got severe gastric necrosis. It just may be that that lactate is leaking out into the systemic circulation, and actually that dog's going to do quite well. Once we decompress the stomach and we restore the blood flow, that high tissue lactate is going to start going back into the systemic circulation, and then we're going to see a high systemic lactate. But that might be reversible. So this is quite a busy slide. What I've tried to do is put together the thoughts about how we're going to interpret lactate. And there are a number of different papers, and they do have different numbers, but this paper was quite interesting because it looked at things other than just the initial lactate. So some of the early papers looked at a lactate of 9 as a cutoff for whether animals would survive or not. But actually a lactate of 9 is pretty high, and we don't often see that. But sometimes we do, and sometimes we see lactates of 12 in animals who do absolutely fine. So they said, yes, it's useful to look at the initial lactate and whether it's high, but actually what's more important is to look at the absolute change and the percentage change in lactate after fluid resuscitation. So if the absolute change isn't enough, so if you have a high initial lactate and the change is less than 4 millimoles per litre or less than about 40%, then for an individual dog there is a higher chance that that dog will have gastric necrosis, major complications and a large bill. And the reason we said there's a higher chance in an individual dog is because the gastric necrosis and the complications being higher are within an entire population of dogs. So if we take all of the dogs with a high initial lactate and a poor change, then they will be statistically significantly more likely to have gastric necrosis and complications than the dogs who had a greater change. But it can't tell you what's going to happen to an individual dog. So what we would say to an owner is, we have a higher chance of problems. You do have a higher chance of a large bill, and obviously that's very important, but your dog could still be fine. So we can't say for definite. Conversely, if we go over and look at the dogs who have either a normal lactate on presentation or it's slightly raised and it stays low during fluid resuscitation, or if it's initially high but comes down with fluids, then we'll say that complications are much less likely than in other dogs, but they're still possible. Because obviously we can't predict what's going to happen later on. We don't know whether an animal's going to develop an arrhythmia. We don't know whether an individual animal will develop SIRS when we weren't expecting it to. So we won't give our clients guarantees, but it's really useful to say to them, in a population of dogs, dogs like yours tend to do worse, but some can do very well. We also need to remember that on first presentation, the magnitude of the hyperlactemia is only going to reflect how severe lactate production is. So it basically tells you how bad tissue hypoxia is at that moment. It doesn't tell you whether it's reversible or not. And as mentioned before, it doesn't predict survival in individual dogs. The exception to that, and think back to the hyperlactemia slide where I talked about SIRS and the type B hyperlactemia, if we have a dog who has a high initial lactate that either stays the same or makes very little change or actually increases despite appropriate fluid therapy, death is likely if we can't treat the underlying cause. And note that I've said appropriate fluid therapy. When I was first treating GDV dogs, in hindsight, I realized that the fluid I gave may well not have been sufficient, not necessarily on first presentation, but actually in the operative period and the immediate post-operative period. So we'll talk about post-op fluid therapy later on, and actually, surprisingly, dogs don't need as high a fluid rate as you might expect, because actually they tend not to have hypovolemic shock, because they have the maldistributive shock. If we don't give appropriate fluid therapy, then the lactate isn't going to go down. So I wouldn't want to say, oh dear, we're not having a change in lactate here. This animal is in a population of animals who don't tend to do well if we haven't got the fluid therapy right, because we are not going to see a change of lactate if we are not improving perfusion. So we need to be very careful to know what appropriate fluid therapy is. Radiography is useful. It used not to be done very often with the GDV dogs decades ago, because radiography was so difficult because of wet processing, but actually radiographs can be taken relatively quickly nowadays. So it's worth taking those radiographs to determine whether you have got a GDV rather than a simple gastric dilation. It's also really useful to just shuffle the tube up and get a radiograph of those lungs as well to demonstrate whether we've got an aspiration pneumonia. You can make the diagnosis on a single right lateral radiograph. And if you're not used to looking at radiographs, then what I will always do is try to think about where fluid and gas should be sitting in a normal dog and in a dog with a GDV. So normally the pylorus is on the right-hand side. If you're in right lateral recumbency, that should be fluid-filled. If you have a GDV, given that they're normally 180 degrees torsion, they'll be on the left and they'll be gas-filled. So we tend to see them up here in the cranial dorsal abdomen. You can see the little line here. So there's that little tissue line that we see in GDVs. And we've also got gas dilated intestines up here as well. You see a little bit more clearly in this dog who's not got quite as much fluid, not as much gas in the abdomen, that very clear line and the C shape of the stomach that's quite classic for GDV dogs. If you're not sure, you can take other radiographs. So you can do left laterals and VDs. You could decompress the stomach, you could potentially lavage the stomach and repeat the radiographs. The other thing to do is assess the clinical parameters. If this dog clinically looks like a GDV and has a dilated stomach, take it to theatre for a laparotomy. The worst thing that would happen is that it only had a dilation. You can still decompress it and do the gastropexy, and I think that's better than missing a GDV. Okay, briefly on the medical stabilisation. We're wanting to stabilise the cardiovascular, respiratory and renal systems enough for anaesthesia. We're not going to get these dogs completely normal, but we want to make sure that we're making a difference and getting them as stable as we can do. And luckily, most of the time by using a simple crystalloid fluid therapy, we can correct the electrolytes and acid-base imbalances. If we do demonstrate a hypoglycemia, we can specifically treat with glucose. I mentioned before I will use two large bore catheters in the cephalic veins, not the saphenous. You can put jugular lines in, but I think two good cephalics are sufficient. And we generally just start off with a Hartmann's resuscitation. But remember in the postoperative period to think about supplementing one of your fluid bags with potassium, because we will develop a hypokalemia otherwise. Other things to remember, oxygen therapy. These animals do warrant antibiotics and they do warrant analgesia as well. I do like to decompress them, not straight away, because obviously we need to get the fluid therapy in them first, because we don't want to release myocardial depressant factor and nitric oxide before we've put them on fluids, because we're worried about maldistributive shock and we don't want to make that any worse. The other thing is, by decompressing the stomach, we would reduce the damage to it. So it's not going to be as dilated, so the blood vessels in the gastric wall can potentially have blood flowing through them again. We might be able to change the position of the stomach, and by reducing the pressure on the systemic veins, then we can improve blood flow, and that includes blood flow to the stomach. But as I said before, remember, we will get a reperfusion injury potentially when those toxins are released. What option you choose depends upon you. There's been a paper that's looked at a comparison between percutaneous decompression and stomach tubing. Both work seemingly equally well. I have to admit to not being a huge fan of stomach tubing in conscious dogs, because I think it's quite difficult to do and I think dogs resent it a lot. So whilst it is an option, for me personally, I have more of a tendency to clip the abdomen and just decompress with a needle. And I might do that repeatedly during the process of stabilizing the animal. Stomach tubing is really useful though when the animal is asleep. Sometimes the tube will go straight down and we can decompress. The other thing is, we may decompress actually once we've derotated the stomach, when the animals are open surgery. I think it's really nice then to get an assistant to stomach tube the animal and actually get some of those gastric contents out. Arrhythmias, when do we treat them? So it used to be said that they didn't need treating unless we've got clinical signs of poor tissue perfusion. This is really more of a parameter for the postoperative period, because obviously on presentation, GDV dogs have poor tissue perfusion. But the criteria used to be to say in animals who have pre-existing cardiac disease, if there was a persistent multiform ventricular rhythm, or if there was R on T, so superimposition of the QRS on the T. And most early studies showed that treating with lidocaine didn't make any difference to whether arrhythmia is resolved. However, a more recent paper has said that treating on presentation with lidocaine, comparing it with historical data, show that animals were less likely to develop arrhythmias and less likely to develop acute kidney injury. However, it's probably only likely that lidocaine will have its best effect if you start that before decompressing the stomach. So if they are already on lidocaine before we release the toxins. So it's just something else to consider for the future. So surgery. I think surgery for me certainly got easier once I had seen more of these, and really once I'd figured out how to decompress them a little bit quicker. So, but just a few comments on anesthesia. I'll always pre-oxygenate. I do always pre-treat with an opioid, so I would give methadone. I'm not overly worried about respiratory depression. I'm much more concerned about the animal being painful, and actually without methadone the anesthetic is a lot harder. Anesthetic agents will really depend upon what you're used to using. So it's quite nice to do induction with a combination of, for example, fentanyl and midazolam, but GDV patients are not the ones to be starting out trying out new anesthetics. So a lot of people will be quite happy just using a propofol induction because that's what they're used to. But if you are very experienced, it would be worth giving consideration to different methods of anesthesia and using them in not such an intense emergency situation, so that when the GDV case comes in, then you know how to use them. So this is what we call our tower of power, and you can see how many different jugs we potentially will be needing to use. So we might be wanting to have jugs to support blood pressure. We might choose to use fentanyl to reduce the amount of anaesthetic agent we need to give. We may have the animal on a lidocaine infusion. So these are quite intense and difficult anaesthetics to do. Obviously, it makes life really hard if it's just you and a nurse within your practice. So again, how much you're able to do will really depend upon the circumstances that you're working in. So I've got some pictures here to show some GDV cases. This is the classic view when we go in. So the omentum is stretched across the stomach here like this. Now ordinarily, if you were to look at a stomach, if you think that this would be the caudal edge of the stomach, the omentum then goes in a caudal direction. So you would expect to see the ventral surface of the stomach with no omentum on it. If a stomach is covered in omentum all the way to the cranial abdomen, then definition, you do have a GDV. So that's diagnostic for you. The other thing you might notice looking at this stomach is it's very, very bruised. It's kind of dark red or purple. Don't panic if you see that to start with. Because this stomach is really, really stretched, it's going to be looking unhealthy. And once you've derotated and decompressed the stomach and the blood flow comes back to this tissue, in a lot of cases, we'll find that quite quickly that stomach goes back to being a pink colour again. Not necessarily a normal pink, and many of them will stay quite red. It's because essentially they're bruised, but that purple discoloration will often disappear. So don't panic overly at this point. Now what I'll do here, because it's very difficult to see what's going on, and I don't think it's, personally for me, I've ever found a way of being able to see what's happening. I tend to do it all by feel. And almost every GDV will go in a clockwise direction. If you're unlucky enough to have one that goes anti-clockwise, will be a really hard case to derotate, but I can't even remember having seen an anti-clockwise one in my career, and I know of occasional people who've seen them, but they are extremely rare. So have a think about what happened. Think back to that the schematic diagram I showed you at the beginning, and the pylorus started off here and it went in that direction. And so that means that the first thing I will do is put my hands up here in the cranial left abdomen and have a feel for something that feels like the pylorus. And you don't always get it first time. Sometimes you find the duodenum, and if you find the duodenum, then you have to follow it in this direction. Because remember, if you go in that direction, you're going to go down to the rest of the duodenum. So I'll follow it around here, and then eventually when you get to the pylorus, it feels different to the rest of the stomach because it is firmer, and you can feel where it goes from duodenum into pylorus, you get a slight widening into the pyloric antrum. So I don't do anything until I've got hold of that. If you pull on the duodenum, generally I find all that happens is that the duodenum stretches, and that's not enough to derotate the stomach. So I want to get hold of the pylorus here, and then I'm going to pull it back in this direction. So it's going to go ventral and to the right. And at the same time, I put a flat hand on the body of the stomach and I want to push that down and under to the left. And if we can do that effectively, then that stomach should be untwist in just one movement. It's important to take the time to find the various bits to get a really good hold on the pylorus and a good flat hand on the body of the stomach, and hopefully if that goes well, then we can get this stomach back into position. So we've got a slightly different view here. This is the left side and the cranial aspect, and actually quite a small stomach in comparison to the last one, although it is still a gastric dilatation of volvulus. So we had duodenum here. This was the pyloric antrum, and it's being held actually quite loosely at the moment, but it's being pulled over ventrally into the right, and then the body of the stomach is now being pushed down and to the left. It would be useful in the previous case, remember to use the flat of the hand, because this one was quite small, the tips of the fingers were sufficient. And then we're going to pop it back into place, and then we're going to see the classic presentation of the stomach in that there is absolutely no omentum over it, because the omentum is over here. It's very, very dilated at the moment, so it's not looking as though it's in its perfect position, and it's difficult to determine what's what, but we're now going to pass the stomach tube, and actually I'll give a gentle squeeze of the stomach to get rid of any fluid or gas if the gastric contents don't come out easily, then I will ask the assistant on the stomach tube to actually pour water into the stomach, and I'll agitate it and we'll gently squeeze to try and get the fluid out that way. This is, I would consider this an extremely healthy stomach post-GDV. And yet despite it, you look at it and think, well, actually, that's very bruised, it's very hyperemic. I think that's fine. It's quite normal, and that will be back to its normal self within about 10 minutes. If we look at this one, this stomach's also just been decompressed. It's extremely red here. That redness will also go away in 10 minutes. What we're worried about is little areas like this. So this is looking quite deep purple or black. Again, that might regain its colour when we decompress. If it doesn't, and it still looks like that 10 minutes later, then we know we're going to have to resect that portion. And just another thing to think about doing, have a look around the rest of the abdomen in this dog. Make sure there isn't anything else unusual. Make sure there's no foreign bodies that have set it off. But I generally don't take gut biopsies, despite knowing that some dogs with GDVs can have inflammatory bowel disease. I don't think this is a time to be taking gut biopsies, particularly because of the risk of dehiscence. So I'll have a look around and make sure nothing else is going on, but I certainly won't be doing any other major procedures. Now, this is a pretty extreme example of gastric necrosis. You can see the various different colours, abnormal colours we've got. So we've got some black, we've got some purple, some brown and some grey. So there's quite a lot of different ways it can look. And here we've actually quite a nice line of demarcation. Here we've got some really red stomach, but that's going to be fine. And then back over here we've got some normal pink stomach. For me, this is a pretty large area of necrosis, but it's in a very, very classic position on the left-hand side around where the short gastric arteries had come away. Now, in order to remove this, we have to think about how we're going to cut the stomach out. We're going to cut the omentum off. You can't quite see it here, but the omentum is attached around the greater curvature. That's got to be removed. And in an ideal world, if you've got lots of assistance to help you, you can isolate the stomach. You can see here I've got a selection of stay sutures and clamps in place, and I'm going to remove this with staples. This was a case I did working in a university, so I had plenty of people to help, but it can take quite a few hands. But the advantage of doing this is if you use the a gastrointestinal stapler, places two layers of staples and then it cuts in between them, which means that you instantly have sealing of the stomach. So all you have to do is fire the staple across here. This is the bit that's going to come out. This is what's staying behind. We haven't quite made it all the way across. And so I just did it this time with a thoracoabdominal stapler, just because it's a little bit cheaper and it's easy enough to do that across quite a small portion. So here, a little bit of tissue. So we're just clamping across there and then cutting the bit of stomach that's going to come out. And here's a really nicely stapled edge of stomach. Pretty quick procedure, but we're needing help from other people. So this was the body of the stomach on the left, and then here we've got the rest of the stomach down there on the right, and then up here that we can't see is the cardia. And so we still need to make sure that we can have flow of ingesta through the stomach, so obviously we can't remove too large a portion in this area. But usually my experience has been that most gastric necrosis cases are partial and they are amenable to resection. So there's the nasty piece of necrotic tissue that's been removed. Now sometimes we're working on our own, and I'm quite happy to do a single-handed GDV, but what I can't do is do a single-handed stapling of a large area of stomach, because there's just too much tissue to hold with two hands. I certainly don't want to cut the stomach and then sew the edges together, because there's just too much content within the stomach. And so in those cases I will invaginate. And actually, so if I just go, I'm just going to get pop back to, excuse me for popping back through the slides, going back to this case here, what we will find is obviously there will be this line of demarcation and it will stop here and go around the other side. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a my first suture. It's got to engage the submucosa because we are going to get sloughing of stomach. So we need to engage the submucosa because that's the strength holding layer. I'm going to put my first anchoring suture here. I'm going to put a suture here. Then I'm going to go to the other side of the necrotic area to good stomach, put a suture there, back to this side, back to the other side. A little bit like if you were doing an inverting suture after having done a gastrotomy, or if you do those for the uterus after a cesarean section, but we're doing it with this necrotic tissue in place. So we have to make sure that the suture line goes all the way along here in healthy tissue and on the other side. I'm just going to jump back ahead to that slide I was doing here. So I started off here. You can see where my forestep is holding that suture, and I had been alternating on either side of the necrotic tissue, and you can see that I've invaginated. So you now can't see that necrotic tissue, but it's on the inside. As we come up here, you can see I'm trying to push this necrotic tissue inwards. I'm invaginating it. I've got my suture here. Then I'm going to put another suture here and then go to the other side and keep pulling as I go until I've got all of this invaginated and then stop the suture line. What I would generally do then is do another Lembert or some other choice of inverting suture, because I do find it's quite difficult to actually get that tight enough, and I would worry a little bit about leaking between the gaps. And this dog's going to feel pretty uncomfortable afterwards, because that invaginated necrotic stomach is going to have to be auto-digested, and eventually that's going to come out as some pretty horrific diarrhea. But this dog can be managed by a single-handed surgeon by doing this. We may see problems with the spleen, so sometimes we will see splenic necrosis, splenic infarction, and in this case it's just part of the spleen that's affected, but I would take that spleen out. And the other thing we may see is splenic torsion. So it's quite difficult to see here, but there's a torsion around the splenic pedicle, and you can see how congested this spleen is. So if there's a splenic torsion in conjunction with a GDV, then I would take the spleen out as well. My choice for apexy is an incisional, a linear incisional gastropexy. It's the quickest and easiest to do. So circumcostals have lost favour because they tend to be too likely to induce a pneumothorax. And having done that, I can tell you it's extremely difficult to try and manage a pneumothorax and finish your gastropexy, particularly if there are only two of you present. So for me, circumcostals are out, and belt loops are just a little bit too fiddly to do. So there's nothing wrong with a nice incisional gastropexy. Incision on the right-hand side, caudal to the ribs, through the peritoneum and the muscles of the abdominal wall. We're going to do a similar length incision, so somewhere between 4 and 6 centimeters, depending upon the size of the dog. We're going to do the incision in the pyloric antrum, halfway between the greater and lesser curvatures, where there's no blood. And then we're going to start suturing those together. And we're going to suture the cranial edge together first to make it easier to then suture the caudal edge. And it's basically a simple continuous suture, full thickness through the abdominal wall and through the serosa and submucosa and muscularis of the stomach, and then that will form a nice pexy. A nice, quick, easy surgery to do with a single-handed surgeon. I tend to stay operating on the right-hand side and lean in. For me, that's the easiest way to do it, and with abdominal retractors, that's a surgery that you can do on your own. It should take about 10-15 minutes to do that surgery. Simple, continuous, all the way round, just to make that quicker. You can do it in the other direction as well. So this is a horizontal. They can end up being diagonal. It doesn't really matter how they're sitting, as long as you can get the stomach in the most comfortable position so that we don't have any rotation on it, because we don't want the animal to have a partial volvulus. You can do tube gastropexies. They're not as strong. They are more difficult to manage, and generally animals don't tend to need decompressing in the post-operative period. So for me, a tube gastropexy isn't necessary, and given that it may not be as strong as a linear incisional, that's why it's not my preference. People have worried about the new pyloric position, because we pull them so far caudally And there's been a CT study of the type of breed of dog that gets a GDV, and they show that the ribs, the pylorus is normally at the level of the 9th to 10th rib, and it's quite a long way to the 13th rib. So we may get quite a considerable displacement of the pylorus relative to normal when we do a gastropexy. However, it probably doesn't make a difference, because we've wondered whether gastropexy affects motility, because we know that if you study GDV dogs, they have hypomotility, but we don't know whether that's because of the gastropexy, or we didn't know whether it was because of the gastropexy or because the hypomotility caused the GDV. But a couple of studies have tried to address this. The first was looking at the effects of the gastropexy. So they took dogs who were normal, experimental dogs were normal, they gave them a gastropexy, they had normal motility, which means gastropexy alone doesn't affect motility. If we have a dog who's had a GDV and a pexy and has abnormal motility, as most of them do, it's not the pexy that's caused it, it's the underlying disease. Similarly, if we induce a GDV in a normal dog, as has been done experimentally, and then we follow them up, we see that they have normal motility afterwards. And that suggests that the abnormal motility caused the GDV and it isn't the effect of it. So these just answer some questions that have always been around. Okay, just to finish up, we're at the end of our time, but we'll just bring this to a close. Think about what we're aiming to do postoperatively. We need to keep that tissue perfusion and monitor for any signs of reperfusion injury. So whether animals are getting SIRS, whether they're getting organ dysfunction, particularly whether they're getting acute kidney injury. Look for development of cardiac arrhythmias, which can occur in the postoperative period. Monitor our electrolyte imbalances. So there's lots and lots to think about. And also make sure that there's no reason that we may need to reoperate. So occasionally animals will develop septic peritonitis, particularly if we overlooked a piece of stomach that actually was necrotic and we thought it didn't. And occasionally some dogs will develop a thrombus in the splenic vein. So make sure we keep these animals on antibiotics. There's a lot of talk about not overusing antibiotics, and when we use antibiotics prophylactically, it's not been possible to demonstrate that there is a flow of bacteria across the gastric wall, but these animals have been hypovolemic, hypoperfused, and have bits of the intestine that are hypoperfused. It makes sense to want to keep them on antibiotics. But a broad spectrum, something like potentiated amoxicillin is fine. We have lots of analgesic options available to us, so we can use opioids, lidocaine and ketamine, CRIs, but we do avoid non-steroidals for obvious reasons related to hypovolemia and gastrointestinal health. And we do want animals to eat early. Actually, I don't often put an O-tube in these dogs. Some people do. We want to try and encourage early enteral feeding. If animals are not eating quickly after a GDV, then I would be much more proactive about getting an O-tube in them within a couple of days. But most dogs do tend to eat in the early postoperative period. Our fluid therapy is, as in the preoperative period, going to be entirely based on perfusion and usually clinical parameters of perfusion. We can monitor lactate. We particularly want to monitor creatinine to make sure the animal's not developing an acute kidney injury. And because not much of the shock is hypovolemic, as I said before, we usually find that somewhere in the region of 5 mL per kilo per hour is sufficient for the first 24 hours. But obviously that's going to depend upon individual dogs. If arrhythmias are going to develop, it's generally within the first 24 to 48 hours. Make sure that you've thought about the treatable causes of it. So is the animal hypoxic, particularly when they're first presenting? Could there be hypokalemia or any other acid-base disturbance that if we can correct that will resolve the arrhythmia? And as I mentioned before, we can treat with lidocaine, boluses and CRIs, particularly if we see any of the clinical parameters that suggest reduced perfusion. You may have already considered giving them a lidocaine CRI from presentation. We want to think about respiration as well in the postoperative period, and we're going to be looking clinically for parameters that suggest that there are problems with ventilation, and particularly worrying about whether animals may have had a preoperative or then develop a postoperative aspiration pneumonia, and make sure we have appropriate antibiotic therapy for those dogs. These animals will have gastrointestinal dysfunction. They have hypomotility, that's why they developed a GDV, but also any animal who has an acute abdominal crisis is going to be at risk of developing hypomotility on top of anything else that was underlying it. So it's good to be proactive with the drugs to protect the gastrointestinal tract, and the sorts of things that are available to us are the antacids, the prokinetics, and the antiemetics. So it's nice to consider giving a metoclopramide, CRI in particular, if we think an animal may have ileus. If the animal's feeling sick, we may want to give meropotent, for example. Ondansetron may be something that you can give if the meropotent isn't working. So there's various options available to us. Coagulation dysfunction doesn't commonly present a clinical problem. Most animals who have GDV will have some degree of coagulation dysfunction. We don't tend to specifically treat them unless we have other indicators that animals are developing clinical signs of DIC. And in those cases, if they have the clinical signs in conjunction with the abnormal coag profile, we might want to think about using fresh frozen plasma. We want to be proactive in looking for acute kidney injury, so it's good to monitor creatinine serially, so once or twice a day, and look for increasing even if it's still normal. So it might still be within the normal range, but if it's suddenly creeping up over 24 hours, we would want to monitor that. And so we can place a urinary catheter, we can measure the animal's ins and outs. And if we see an animal is developing oliguria and overhydration, then we may want to think about using drugs to combat that. So the use of furosemide and mannitol, for example. And just to mention it again, that lidocaine might reduce the incidence of ischemic or reperfusion injury, but to try and give it before decompression, although this is just a suggestion, it hasn't been proven that giving it before decompression will make a difference. And remember that not all papers have showed that lidocaine does have an effect on arrhythmias, but it has been shown to decrease acute kidney injury. And finally, we'll look at outcome. So the mortality rate is really related to a couple of things, particularly whether the animal has GDV alone or whether it has gastric necrosis. So there are all sorts of ranges for survival. So GDV alone has a mortality rate of between 0 and 15%, depending upon the studies we read. Gastric necrosis, somewhere between 25 and 62%. What is important to note is that gastropexy is really the most important factor that we will have for recurrence. So animals who don't have a gastropexy are almost destined, really, to have a recurrence. If we do a gastropexy, it's still possible to have a recurrence. So the stomach can still tears despite having the pexy in place, but we can just go and redo the pexy. But it's always worth doing. There's not really any question that we wouldn't do that gastropexy. Some factors that are related to whether the animals survive really depends upon how they present. So if they're depressed, in a coma, recumbent, hypothermic, hypertensive, it really goes without saying, a poor clinical presentation, they are more likely to die, as with the animals who've got gastric necrosis, and particularly animals who develop a persistently or have a persistently high lactate or develop AKI have a higher mortality. Long term, it basically comes down to whether they've been pexied and therefore whether they recur. So we will always want to do that gastropexy. Just briefly to mention prophylactic gastropexy, the recommendations from various studies in the US have said that in these high-risk dogs, the Dane, Irish Setter, the Rottweiler, the Standard Poodle and the Weimaraner, so those dogs that they studied in particular, Given the lifetime risk, which is as much as 37%, it's worth doing a gastropexy, again, particularly in the Great Dane, because you can see that the proof is that they reduce the mortality by 30%. It won't be cost effective in anything other than the Great Dane. So it's only if the lifetime risk factor is 34%. But obviously, owners aren't doing it because of the cost. They're doing it because of the fear of having a GDV. Whether you would do it in a Rottweiler with a 4% lifetime risk and be twice as less likely to die, obviously would depend upon individual owners. Other high-risk dogs, be anyone who's had the first-degree relative with a GDV, any dog that's had a splenic torsion. So having a splenectomy doesn't put you at risk of a GDV, but the dogs who have a splenic torsion probably have the same pathophysiology as the animals who have a GDV. So those dogs should be gastropexied. I'm not going to go into it in any detail here, but laparoscopic gastropexy is obviously available as an alternative. It is as successful as a surgical gastropexy, and with experience it will be as quick or potentially even quicker than open surgery. There are potential risks associated with laparoscopy, but really a lot of that will be operator dependent. And just to mention, for the future, there may well be more information coming out about GDVs because there's been some funding made available for the American Kennel Club. So hopefully we will see some more research in the future and maybe be able to improve survival then. Okay, so that's us at the end, and I'm just having a pause here while I'm reading some questions that have come through. Just bear with me as I scroll across. Where would you do the incision on the stomach for the gastropexy? So this needs to be at the pyloric antrum. So if you find the pylorus of the stomach, so it's a very, very firm bit of stomach just by the duodenum, if you come more towards the left, so I would start the incision probably about 1 or 2 centimetres from what I consider to be the true pylorus, and then go towards the left between the greater and the lesser curvatures for about 4 to 6 centimetres, depending upon the breed of dog. The other question is, what suture material would you use and whether you'd use a permanent suture? Actually, no, you don't. PDS is fine because it's the scarring of the pexy that will form the adhesion, not the suture itself. And so just using a size 2-0 or a 0 should be sufficient. I don't see any other questions. So unless anyone's got one that they're going to quickly pop up, I think it's time to say thank you very much for listening. My apologies for going over by my usual 15 minutes, I have to confess. I hope it's been helpful, and good luck in treating your future cases.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alison for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.